The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 27/March 6, 2023. It is, as usual, outlined in a red border on the front cover, with the narrow white inner border, with a gray background over which is superimposed Time, T-I-M-E, in large white block letters. Up at the corner where you turn the page, it says Our 100th Year. There are no pictures or graphics on the front cover. It says things. It says HI Chat GPT. It says hello, how can I assist you today? These are accompanied by icons, which I don't understand, a capital T and kind of a swirly circle in a box. What do you think of a Time cover story with the title, The AI Arms Race is Changing Everything? Now I'm going on to one of the first articles in this edition, the brief, Preventable Devastation, by Simone Shaw. In Turkey, a pair of lethal earthquakes indicts a government. There is a photo here. It's not on the front cover, but it's on the first page of this article. It is nearly full page. It is nearly all gray. It is absolutely all rubble. Oh. Buildings are leaning sideways. Roofs are on the ground, either in a smashed up mess of debris or kind of on a diagonal across the street. There's a silver-gray car smashed under the rubble that probably fell off a wall or a roof. There's a man standing on this diagonally placed rooftop with more men ascending above him onto what was once a rooftop. In the background is a pale blue sky. It is the only thing that adds light to this dreary, dreary landscape. On to the text. In Turkey, located between several plate boundaries and directly on two main fault zones, earthquakes are a fact of life. But the two that hit the country's southern reaches February 6 brought a level of destruction that numbers can only suggest. A 7.8 magnitude quake followed 9 hours later by a tremblor registering 7.5. The death toll 9 days later stood at 41,000, including thousands killed across the nearby border in northern Syria. These are the kinds of quakes we would expect to see 10 or 20 years apart, says Kunate Tuzun, an earthquake engineer based in Izmir, Turkey. They happened within a few hours of each other. They also happened in a country that, despite every warning, had not prepared. 10 years after a 1999 earthquake in the northern city of Izmit killed over 17,000 people, the Turkish government answered the outrage over shoddy construction, pledging new building standards and a plan to strengthen existing structures, and designating hundreds of open urban spaces as evacuation-safe zones. The measures were crucial in a rapidly urbanizing nation where millions reside in the multi-story concrete apartment buildings that carpet Turkish cities. Yet February 6, more than 5,600 buildings collapsed across southeastern Turkey. Within days, Turkish officials issued over 100 arrest warrants for contractors allegedly connected to the collapse of buildings that were not up to code. But experts tell Time the requirements for earthquake readiness improvements often went unenforced. As recently as last November, following a 5.9 magnitude earthquake, Turkey's Union of Engineers and Architects released a statement saying the nation has failed in terms of what needs to be done before the earthquake. The union added that site supervision continues to be seen as a procedure on paper only, and civil engineers warned the country's infrastructure was incapable of handling a large earthquake. H. Kit Miyamoto, a structural engineer at Miyamoto International, went to Turkey to help assess the latest damage. He says that in 1997, Turkey passed a code that required buildings to be constructed using ductile concrete, a material that is more flexible in the event of an earthquake, but he estimates only 1 in 10 buildings in the country meets the standard. Engineers can reinforce older buildings through retrofitting, a process that is more cost-effective than constructing a building from scratch. But Miyamoto, who has worked with the World Bank to retrofit schools in Turkey, says it's difficult to force private buildings to do so. It costs on average 10% to 15% of the replacement cost, says Miyamoto. You could retrofit 8 buildings for the price of building 1, he adds, but seismic retrofitting does not add market value. The construction industry is a big source of money, explains Tuzun, the earthquake engineer, alluding to politics. Turkey, which has been governed for 20 years by the Justice and Development Party of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has been increasingly seen as corrupt, according to annual rankings by Transparency International. The party faces a challenge from a united opposition in March elections that analysts say the catastrophe will loom large over. The country's southeast, where the earthquakes occurred, has long lagged in income in comparison with the western region, according to a study by the Center for Economic Policy Research, which also making the area more vulnerable to insufficient infrastructure standards, says Tuzun. Ayhan Irfanoglu, a civil engineering professor at Purdue University, says early photos of the earthquake damage show that tall buildings pancaked or slumped on their sides like a deck of cards. Irfanoglu notes local jurisdictions often do not enforce codes, or contractors on the ground do not understand the complex codes they are meant to be implementing. To prevent a tragedy like this from happening again, stakeholders will need to follow through on compliance. Irfanoglu says that as the region recovers, this experience might make towns more aware of the importance of proper building practices. There is an undeniable field of evidence of what works, he says. Tuzun adds, engineers know the infrastructure changes that are necessary to prevent building collapses at this scale, especially in an area where earthquakes are inevitable. Now they must be implemented. Nature is warning us, Tuzun says. If we take proper actions, we will have less loss in the future. Now there's a small inset map here. It's not real clear, but it shows Turkey and Syria adjacent to one another. It referred in the article to the fact that Turkey's southeast, where the earthquakes occurred, has lagged in income in comparison with the western region. Now, in this little inset, it shows on the border of Syria and Turkey, the 7.8 magnitude quake. It is in the south, the very south of Turkey. And just to the north, side by side, on a vertical level, is where the 7.5 magnitude quake occurred. So Syria is to the south, Cyprus is out to the south, Lebanon is to the south, Iraq is way off to the southeast, Georgia is up to the northeast, the Black Sea is to the north, Istanbul, Turkey, is in the northwest of the country, as is the capital, Ankara. And the places where it hit were in the southeast of the country and the northwest of Syria. By the country, I meant Turkey, excuse me. And in the northwest of Syria. There's one more photo here. It's about half a page in size. There is a man sitting on some junk where the rebar is exposed, where the concrete is a bunch of crumbles. It's crumbles. There's a mattress somehow stuck in between two levels of this building with more cushions and mattresses on the level above it, and they have pancaked. They are concrete slabs, one atop another, with all this crumbly junk in between. Anyway, the man is seated on something in this debris pile. He's wearing a bright orange jacket as if he were a construction worker or one of the rescue people. And he is looking straight ahead. He's bearded, looking straight ahead. But his left hand is outstretched and holding a hand which is exposed in between all this junk and rubble under the pancaked section of concrete. The caption reads, Mesut Hanser holds his deceased 15-year-old daughter Irmak's hand. February 7. Under the heading World, How to Help Victims of the Earthquakes. This is by Sulcira Burga. And the previous article, the longer one, was by Simone Shaw. Okay, this one's by Sulcira Burga. The devastating earthquakes that hit Turkey and Syria February 6 struck the heart of the displaced Syrian community on both sides of the border, dramatically affecting one of the most vulnerable populations in the world. Some 4 million Syrians who rely on immediate humanitarian aid live in the region, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. More than 41,000 people died as of February 15, and the affected area of Syria was already confronting a cholera outbreak. Harsh weather makes the situation worse. Many buildings that were left standing are damaged and in danger of collapse, meaning people cannot go home, even if they have one to return to. Turkey's the world's biggest refugee host country, with about 3.6 million Syrian refugees living within its borders, many in southeastern Turkey, near the epicenter of the earthquakes. Albara Haddad, a 27-year-old Syrian living in Turkey and currently in Antakya, says rescue aid was scarce in the immediate aftermath. You could hear people who were still alive under the rubble trying to scream and say they were alive, but there was absolutely no one helping at that moment, Haddad tells Time. In major disasters like earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, experts say the best way to help people is by sending money to relief groups instead of sending goods. Cash allows us to not only be faster, says Patricia McElreevy, president and CEO of the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, but it allows those who are helping these communities be adaptable to what the community needs. Aid groups on the ground. And for links to donate and further information, visit time.com/earthquakes earthquake-help. Aid groups on the ground include these, but I know that it is not limited to these six groups. I know that. The White Helmets, a volunteer group that operates in Syria, especially in territory not under government control. Rescuers need supplies to provide relief to survivors left homeless by the earthquake. Doctors Without Borders. Medical teams are on the ground providing immediate emergency support in northwestern Syria, as well as blankets and relief kits for survivors. Save the Children, a nonprofit coordinating with local partners to distribute goods to children and families. An emergency team is also on the ground providing medical care. International Rescue Committee. The U.S.-based aid group has been working on the ground with Syrian refugees for years. It is sending emergency supplies for children and families. Turkish Red Crescent. Turkey's largest humanitarian organization and part of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent. It is providing mobile kitchens and temporary shelters. Syrian American Medical Society, a relief organization that needs donations to purchase trauma supplies for the injured and to continue to provide emergency aid to patients. Here from the brief news, a big photograph, about a quarter of a page. Oh, no, more than that, more like a third of a page. Oh, goodness, there's green grass or green turf on the ground. There are football players everywhere on this level field. You cannot see the stands because of all the confetti in the air, multicolored confetti, landing on people, landing on the ground, obscuring whoever or whatever is in the stands. And on the top it says KC within that arrowhead emblem, Champion Chiefs. The caption reads, Kansas City Chiefs players celebrate Super Bowl 57 win. February 12, under an explosion of red and gold confetti inside State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona. After Kansas City fell behind in the first half, Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes led his team to a 38-35 win over the Philadelphia Eagles in one of the highest scoring Super Bowls ever. And the Kansas City Chiefs are in the foreground, still in their playing attire, the red and white and yellow striped suits. The Bulletin, Bird Flu Isn't a Danger to Humans Yet, by Haley Weiss, and it features an inset photograph of a large red hen. A particularly nasty strain of the H5N1 virus is currently causing the worst outbreak of the disease among birds since it was first identified in China in 1996. Across the U.S., some 58 million birds have died or had to be killed because of infection, with similar die-offs in poultry farms in Europe and Japan. One of the main reasons eggs have been so expensive lately. The good news, there is no record of any human getting infected with bird flu from eating eggs or poultry products. Experts are not sure why the current bird flu has spread so far so fast, but they do have one theory. While avian flus infect mainly domestic poultry, the recent outbreaks have spread to wild species. There's been a record number of deaths among seabirds, which travel great distances, enabling the spread of H5N1. Further, wild birds make for a nearly impossible-to-track disease vector, moving too fast for researchers to count the infected. In humans, cases have been fairly rare, and there are only a handful of recorded instances of H5N1 being spread from one human to another. As we have seen with SARS-CoV-2, However, viruses can evolve to sidestep biological obstacles. Unusually for H5N1, this strain has already been found in other mammals, including foxes, bears, and in an outbreak at a Spanish mink farm in October. If it mutates into a strain better suited to attack human cells, it could cause trouble. Treat the virus with respect, says Gino Lorenzoni, an avian health expert at Penn State. If you keep chickens, put them where wild animals cannot touch them, and wear full protective gear when handling them. If you have pets, be vigilant about stopping them from picking up any bird carcasses or excrement. And if a seagull tries to steal your sandwich, maybe let it. Under the health heading on this page, five ways to be mindful without meditating, by Angela Haupt. There's a certain disconnect that plagues almost everyone nowadays. Your body's doing one thing, sitting in a meeting, eating dinner with the family, while your brain is miles away. Call it being in two places at once, but mental health experts say it is more problematic. Not being grounded in the moment is an open invitation to stress and unpleasant emotions. Our minds tend to focus on worries about the future or upsets from the past, even when our body may be in a neutral or pleasant place, says Corey Goldberg, a clinical psychologist and founder of Shore Therapy Center for Wellness in the Chicago area. Enter mindfulness. The now ubiquitous concept, which is rooted in Buddhism, is generally defined as turning your attention inward and maintaining an awareness of your thoughts, bodily sensations, and environment. The benefits are vast. A mindfulness practice can help lower stress, reduce anxiety as effectively as medication, in some cases, increase a person's capacity to savor positive experiences, stop disruptive thoughts, promote concentration, and more. Meditation is the best known way to achieve mindfulness, but it is not appealing to and does not work for everyone. Some find it is awkward or anxiety-provoking, or they have trouble sitting still. Fortunately, a person can practice mindfulness while engaged in literally any activity, Goldberg says, and with any available amount of time. Here are five ways to practice mindfulness if meditation is not your thing. 1. Listen to music. Getting lost in a good song is an effective way to practice mindfulness. The first step in listening mindfully is considering what counts as focused attention, Goldberg advises. That way you will be able to tell if your mind starts to wander. For example, being focused on a song might mean noticing the melody, observing how your body feels and moves without judgment, or focusing on the words of the song or the sound of the instruments, she says. If you are midway through a tune and notice you're thinking about your grocery list, let the thought go and return your attention to the beat. 2. Use the 5-4-3-2-1 method. One popular mindfulness exercise can be particularly helpful in moments of panic, when you are grasping for shortcuts to calm. The 5-4-3-2-1 method, as it is often called, involves using all five senses to get into your body and out of your busy mind, says Tina Hanachuk, a mindfulness teacher in British Columbia. She describes it like this: identify five things you can see and four things you can touch. Then search for three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste or that you're grateful for. The exercise helps people feel safe, calm, and at peace, Hanachuk notes. 3. Do a puzzle. In addition to being a fun way to pass time, experts say, jigsaw puzzles exercise your brain, foster creativity, and promote mindfulness. Kelly Neuperk, a psychotherapist in Chicago, likes puzzles because they offer structure without many rules. As you start fitting together knobs and holes, she suggests asking yourself these questions. What does the puzzle piece feel like in your hands? What does the picture on the box look like? How does it feel to fit two pieces together? Do you feel urgency to finish it, or content going at your own speed? Your answers can help center you in the present and push away thoughts about what's about to happen or what has already occurred. 4. Focus on your movements. Even your walks can be more mindful. Joy Raines, author of Meditation Illuminated, Simple Ways to Manage Your Busy Mind, suggests paying attention to your feet, connecting with the ground, and repeating the words, lifting, moving, placing, shifting. As you lift your right leg, silently say lifting, she instructs. As you move forward, say moving, then placing as you make contact with the ground. As you shift your weight to the other foot, note what you are doing, then begin the process again with your left leg. Continue silently repeating these words to yourself as you walk, Raines says. Doing so will help ward off worries. Okay, here's your little saying again. Lifting, moving, placing, shifting. 5. Pay attention to your pet. Say you're heading outside with your mini schnauzer. Instead of allowing your mind to drift to the workday ahead or the errands you need to run, stay focused on the present by cataloging all the things your senses are experiencing, advises Raines. Notice your dog's tail wagging, the sounds of his panting, his nails clicking on the pavement, the feel of his warm breath, she says. Anytime your mind wanders, gently shift your attention back to your dog, even if it's every second or two. Those are 5 ways to be mindful without meditating, and my goodness, just to remember all the instructions requires mindfulness. Here's the brief news, a page that says, good question, why does the U.S. keep shooting down UFOs? This is by Sonia Mansour. There's a photo here. It's kind of pretty. It's square. It's not very large. The background is, I guess, indigo blue or kind of a blue jeans blue. And in the middle, in the very center, is a whitish sphere. And it's white, like the moon, on one side, and it's a little bit gray on the other. But it looks perfectly placed. In the first 2 weeks of February, the U.S. Air Force shot down 4 flying objects that had intruded on the skies over North America, a deployment of force unprecedented during peacetime. The first object shot down February 4 was a Chinese balloon that the Biden administration says was part of a years-long scheme to spy on nations across the earth. But so far, officials have been much less detailed about what the other objects are. One shot down over Alaska, February 10, was described as a car-sized object that did not appear to have a propulsion source. One downed over Canada, February 11, was described as cylindrical, potentially a balloon, but smaller than the Chinese one. And it was not immediately clear what was shot down February 12 over Lake Huron in Michigan. Oh, returning to the photograph I described a couple of minutes ago, here's the caption. The Chinese balloon over Charlotte, North Carolina, February 4, before it was shot down. Returning to the text, the Chinese balloon, which U.S. officials say carried sensors capable of listening to conversations on the ground, revealed an entirely new class of threat to U.S. airspace. Experts say 2 things are happening as a result. First, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, and other agencies tasked with watching for airborne incursions have recalibrated their detection methods to pick up slower-moving objects that they were not previously paying attention to. Second, shooting these objects out of the sky and collecting the wreckage has become a priority, so the military can quickly learn where they're coming from and what threat they pose. We need to get a better sense of what these things are and whether or not they're worth engaging with, says Ian Williams, Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Missile Defense Project. It is probably not aliens, experts say. The White House and intelligence officials have echoed this point. Unidentified flying object in this case means just that, an object that is flying and has not been identified. They could, however, pose a danger, at least to civilian aviation. While the Chinese balloon was at 60,000 feet of altitude, well above the ceiling for passenger planes, the other objects were flying much lower, closer to the 20,000 to 40,000 feet that commercial aircraft reach. Since the U.S. shot down the Chinese balloon off South Carolina and admitted to at least three previous similar incursions into the country in recent years, it has recalibrated its skyward surveillance systems. Experts say NORAD was previously focusing on spotting fast-moving objects that generated a lot of heat. Think missiles, bombers, fighter jets. That means it can be easy to miss slow-moving balloons, which also might not show up as clearly on radar. General Glenn Van Herk, NORAD's commander, previously admitted that the Chinese balloon exposed a gap in American air defenses. Now they have some experience and know what these things look like on radar. They are able to refine filters to look for them more efficiently, Williams says. It's about finding that balance of getting what you need, but not getting so much that you're just chasing flocks of birds around. One advantage of shooting down so many of these objects is that once they are recovered on the ground, they offer a lot for military and intelligence officials to analyze. However, it is unlikely that using Sidewinder air-to-air missiles at about $400,000 a pop, fired from $150 million F-22 stealth fighters, America's premier combat aircraft, will be an economical response in the long term, experts say. Ricky M. Ellison, chairman and founder of Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance, is advocating for greater radar capabilities to ensure the U.S. can simultaneously track these flying objects alongside more traditional threats and understand how best to respond to them. So far, he worries, the American response has been disproportionate compared with China's balloon, which Beijing claims was doing civilian research. China wins that fight a little bit, he says. Look at the cost imposed on us and what we had to spend to defend against that. It is very lopsided. It is likely that all sorts of objects have been floating through U.S. airspace, but shooting them down was not a priority. We chose to tolerate them, Ellison says. Here's the milestones page. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things to report. First of all, scored. LeBron James, an NBA record. February 7 in Los Angeles, LeBron James of the Lakers hit a 14-foot fadeaway jump shot over Kenrick Williams of the Oklahoma City Thunder with 11 seconds left in the third quarter to score his 36th point of the game and 38,388th point of his 20-year career and pass Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the NBA's all-time scoring list. The game stopped. James started crying as the crowd cheered. What perhaps separates James from Michael Jordan in the greatest of all time, GOAT debate, is his all-around play. No one has combined the art of passing with the science of scoring quite like James. The all-time scoring record now belongs to a man for whom scoring was never his standout skill, and he's not done yet. At 38, James is as dominant as ever. That column was written by Sean Gregory. Announced a presidential run by former South Carolina governor and UN ambassador Nikki Haley, February 14, the first major primary challenge to Donald Trump. There's a little inset photo here of Nikki Haley. She's in a bright red dress. She has her shoulder length or longer, dark hair. She has this huge smile on her face, and she's waving to somebody. Declared a national state of disaster, February 13, by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, after widespread flooding affected most of the country's provinces. Derailed a freight train carrying toxic chemicals in East Palestine, Ohio, February 3, causing hundreds of people to evacuate and sparking a federal investigation. Raided the BBC's India offices, February 14, by the country's income tax department after the broadcast of a controversial documentary on PM Narendra Modi. And finally, died. And here is a photo. It has beautiful overtones. The lighting here is spectacular. It goes from dark to lighter to light, left to right. And seated in the center is this gray-haired man dressed in a tuxedo, smiling into a microphone, which is stationed on top of a piano keyboard. And it is Burt Bacharach, a maestro of pop. If the 1960s was a rom-com, composer, producer, musician Burt Bacharach, who died February 8 at 94, wrote the score. The pop professional created optimistic, upbeat orchestrations and jaunty rhythms with the lyricist Hal David for tracks that routinely topped the charts. During an era of iconic protest rock, Bacharach was famous for sunny pop songs. He worked with Dionne Warwick, Tom Jones, Aretha Franklin, Dusty Springfield, Elvis Costello, and many other artists. A new song with Costello was released after Bacharach's death. Julia Zorthian wrote those two paragraphs, and here's a little box that says Bacharach hits in brief, I would guess, 2, 4, 6, 7 are noted. Walk on by. What the world needs now is love, the look of love. I say a little prayer. Promises, promises, raindrops keep falling on my head and close to you. I'm choosing to read just a few paragraphs of this next article. It's the brief news, Politics, Bolsonaro's Surreal New Life as a Florida Man, by Vera Bergengruen. A little more than a month ago, he was leading the fifth largest country in the world. These days, he's wandering around Florida supermarkets, eating fried chicken alone at fast food restaurants, holding court for supporters from the driveway of a modest home owned by a former Ultimate Fighting Champion in a gated community south of Orlando. Here, Bolsonaro's re-emergence in Florida is a bizarre spectacle, even for a state with a long history of providing haven to eccentric characters. the embattled ex-president of Brazil, who has refused to concede his loss in October's election, left the country for the U.S. December 30, 2 days before the inauguration of his successor, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. January 8, Bolsonaro's supporters stormed the Brazilian parliament, Supreme Court, and presidential palace, violently threatening police, destroying property, in an assault with eerie echoes of the attack on the U.S. Capitol carried out by supporters of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro, once dubbed the Trump of the tropics, has been hanging out a couple hours' drive up the Florida Turnpike from his former presidential counterpart. While Trump is plotting the moves of his 2024 campaign, it is unclear what Bolsonaro's future in the Sunshine State has in store. His TikTok account broadcasts carefully curated videos to his 74 million followers, smiling families in Brazilian jerseys, delivering baskets of bread, strawberries, flowers, Nutella. Time-lapse montages set to emotional music, showing Bolsonaro hugging children, long lines of people waiting to snap a photo with him. What is the ex-president of Brazil doing in Florida with his country and his own legal future enmeshed in turmoil? Bolsonaro's original visa, thought to be an A1 designation meant for diplomats and heads of state, would have expired after 30 days. He has now applied for a six-month tourist visa to stay in the U.S. and is waiting for the desired results, says Felipe Alexandra, a Brazilian-American attorney representing Bolsonaro. He would like to take some time off, clear his head, enjoy being a tourist in the United States for a few months before deciding what his next step will be, Alexander tells Time. Time off movies. If Nancy's listening, this is for you. Or if any Nancy is listening, this is for you. Review, The Most Mysterious Bronte, Revealed and Unsolved, by Stephanie Zakarik. You probably know right off the bat whether you are a Wuthering Heights person or a Jane Eyre person. Both, of course, are great. But as chilling as Charlotte Bronte's Mad Wife in the Attic yarn may be, her sister Emily's book, a story of melancholic obsession, of love that seeps into the soil of the grave, of pearl-gray skies and majestic gnarled tree branches, speaks to even darker recesses of the human spirit. It's a book you either embrace forever or want to burn after reading. We know relatively little about the woman who wrote Wuthering Heights, but Frances O'Connor's directorial debut, Emily, which blends fact with fanciful fiction, paints a haunting and sympathetic portrait of the person she might have been. Emma Mackey, Sex Education, plays Emily, next to youngest daughter of an uptight Yorkshire curate, Adrian Dunbar, long widowed. The sheltered and clearly eccentric Emily adores her younger sister Anne, Amelia Getting, whose extravagant imagination dovetails with her own, and older brother Branwell, Finn Whitehead, a painter and aspiring writer who strives to live by romantic ideals. Emily is both shocked and inspired when she sees the words freedom in thought tattooed in floating script on his forearm. But her relationship with her older sister Charlotte, Alexandra Dowling, is fraught. Charlotte's affection for Emily is electrified by passive-aggressive undercurrents, eventually by jealousy. She grasps Emily is somehow both of this earth and not. Early in the movie, she offers a succinct, damning review of her sister's manuscript. It's an ugly book, base and ugly. But one person's base ugliness is another's earthy beauty. And that is the sturdy vine of thought O'Connor traces here. As Mackey plays her, Emily is wild as a thistle. Her eyes seemed to be lit by strange thoughts she dare not speak aloud. Then she meets the young curate, haughty, William Waitman, Oliver Jackson Cohen, who appears to see straight into her soul. In the vision of Emily, it is the intensely erotic but ill-fated love affair between these two that inspires Wuthering Heights. Is that how it really went down? Almost certainly not. Although Waitman was a real person and one with whom Emily Bronte would have been acquainted, he was also reportedly an enormous flirt. Still, there is a kind of emotional truth to the way O'Connor, best known as an actor, having starred in Mansfield Park and AI Artificial Intelligence, tells this story. When Emily finds a tube forthrightly labeled Elixir of Opium among her brother's things, her curiosity is piqued. A few beats later, we see her pinned eyes looking weirder and more feral than before. In real life, poor Branwell really was undone, at least partly by opium. Might Emily have tried it too? Again, unlikely. But the suggestion is that the book she ultimately wrote could not have been more mystically charged, even if she had. Emily, who died at age 30 in 1848, is the most mysterious Bronte, partly because Charlotte, who survived her, appears to have exerted some control over her life story. The best this heady, evocative, unbiopic can do is surf the wave of her unknowability. Even so, Emily poured so much ardent, forbidden energy into Wuthering Heights that it might be considered a spiritual fingerprint. Wherever this book came from, it is as real as the sound of the wind. Eight questions. This is written by Megan McCluskey, and it asks questions of Elizabeth Banks, the actor-filmmaker, on helming the horror comedy Cocaine Bear, the right kind of gore and defying expectations. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yep, 8 questions. Okay. Question. It has been harder for comedies to succeed at the box office. What gives this one an edge? Answer. I thought there was a great opportunity here to make people laugh, but to also take them on a bigger ride where the laughs are just part of it. I love that as a filmmaker, I am able to really take people on a physical, visceral journey in this movie. Question, what drew you to a project about a bear overdosing on cocaine during a botched 1985 drug smuggling operation? Answer, I read this script in April 2020 when chaos was all around, and I just thought, there is no greater emblem of chaos than a bear high on cocaine. More importantly, this is the movie I want to see. I knew there was this high concept hook in The Rampaging Bear, but I knew if I did it right, it would become this very entertaining, heartfelt, fun movie. Question. It is a star-studded cast. Who are you most excited to see tangle with the CGI bear? Answer. There's absolutely no question. Margot Martindale, the audience is not expecting her to be as bold as she is. I had to convince her. She was like, I don't do these stunts. She's 71. But she was down on the ground and on the wires. We built special rigs for her, and she did it. Question. This was one of Ray Liotta's last roles. Did anything surprise you about working with him? Answer. I worked with Ray on a little movie more than a decade ago, so I knew how professional and charming he was. What a big heart the guy had. He did not say no to a single thing. Can you put on this crazy wig, do these crazy stunts, fly to Ireland to make the movie? He did. He came fully game. I am forever grateful for the opportunity to work with the legend, Ray Liotta. Question, there's a lot of gore in Cocaine Bear. What do you think gore adds to a movie? Answer, gore is a way to process trauma, with a little more fun. If someone were to pull their fingernail off, I would throw up. The straight-up reality of a trauma is not interesting to me. You have to oversell it. I wanted to acknowledge the reality of a bear attack. Bears eat their prey alive. They are capable of literally ripping somebody's body part off. We did the research. So it was like, how do we let the audience process this in a way that remains fun? Question, are there movies with a similar madcap style that you took particular inspiration from? Answer, I loved making Slither with James Gunn, but I also looked further back to Evil Dead and John Carpenter. I had a true North Star in the original Jurassic Park because this is less of an animal attack movie, more of a man's hubris is the real villain. Another one was Stand By Me, with these kids encouraging adult scenarios that challenge them, and they lose their innocence. And then Pulp Fiction. Question, how do you decide where to focus your energy when it comes to acting versus directing? Answer, directing requires a commitment of my entire life. I have to be so passionate about the material, I am willing to turn my life over to it. That does not happen often. With every job, I have to have a few reasons to leave the house. Am I going to be challenged? Am I going to surprise people? Am I going to be able to disappear into this? Question. You told Variety you wanted to break down some of the mythology around what kinds of movies women are interested in making. Did you feel like you had something to prove as a female director taking on this kind of story? Answer. I did not feel personally like I had something to prove. I just try and lead by example. I never want to be put in a box. I do not want people to have any expectation about what an Elizabeth Banks movie is or who I am as an actor. I have broken out of a lot of boxes in my career. I want to continue to surprise not just the audience, but myself. This is the DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. It may be abridged due to time restraints. When a Furby-decked representative, Marjorie Taylor Greene, yelled, "Liar!" February 7, she was among the loudest in an abrupt chorus of boos hurled at the oldest president to ever deliver a State of the Union address. Joe Biden did not miss a beat. He smiled and went off script. As GOP lawmakers tried to rebuff his claim, they were ready to gut social entitlement programs. Social Security and Medicare's off the books now, right? We've got unanimity, he asked. The striking exchange and Biden's ease in handling it in front of an audience of millions demonstrated why the Democratic establishment is not ready to toss their 80-year-old standard bearer overboard just yet. Despite a halting start to his speech, Biden held his own when Republican hecklers started to stalk him. In fact, he actually demonstrated how he could troll them into a self-own in real time. Give Biden acrimony, he'll toss it back. Accomplishments. Throw him hostility, he'll offer hope. As my football coach used to say, lots of luck in your senior year, he deadpanned at one point, mocking lawmakers who seemed to think high school was the same as the big leagues of Congress. For as much as they are girding for the worst, when it comes to his 2024 campaign, Biden's speech gave Democrats reason to latch onto optimism that they also might get to keep the White House. Biden showed he can hold his ground in the face of Republican attack, even delighting in the political skills he mastered over 36 years in the Senate. He might not be the most dynamic nominee in waiting Democrats have ever had, but he is hardly the most problematic. The night also proved why Republicans who had hoped hectoring could rattle a doddering old man were left hoarse, but without much to show for it, other than plenty of eye rolls from voters who already think Washington unworthy of respect. Now, this may be a bridge for time constraints. A Century of Impact, The Power of a Time Cover by D.W. Pine. Thanks to a mom who archived my childhood, I still have my artwork from Mrs. Matusik's kindergarten class 50 years ago. It is where I learned to color inside the lines. Clearly, the instruction made an impression. As creative director of time, I have spent almost half of my life coloring inside the blank canvas of the magazine's cover. Every issue, I aim to create a poster for our times within its border. That frame came into being another half century before my childhood artistic endeavors, when in Time co-founder Britton Haddon's New York City office, a friend of his named Philip Cobb took out a red crayon and drew a thick line around the cover of a 1926 copy of the magazine. These days, we're often told that to be creative, we need to think outside the box. But as 5,223 issues and counting have shown over time's past 100 years, creativity can flourish inside the lines. Thank you, Mrs. Matusik. Thank you, Mrs. Matusik, by D.W. Pine, who is Time's creative director. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.